unsurpassed renown and wondrous are my Israel, that with even 100,000 million kalvos, now we can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May we unfold the meaning of the darkest truth.
I'd like to introduce my friend, Elihu Gemio-Smith, from Prairie Zen Center in Champaign, Illinois. And I'm going to open this up because I never get people's dates right, and I want you to know accurately about him. Daniel began his Zen training in 1974 at the Zen Studies Society in New York with Soen Nakagawa Roshi and Edo Shimano Roshi. Soen Nakagawa was from Japan, and he was very, very influential in bringing Zen practice to America, and we are indebted to him. You know, he's Rinzai, and we think, well, we have nothing to do with those Rinzai people, but we are very indebted to Soen Nakagawa for helping people in America to sit, and also, actually, to Edo Shimano, who developed one of the first Zen monasteries in America, in New York. And Gemio continued his training at Zen Center of Los Angeles, where he was ordained a Buddhist priest by Hakuyu Taizan Maizumi Roshi. And Maizumi Roshi needs to be included. In morning service, we say the Zen founders in America, and we say Shogaku Shunryu and Jikai Daimin. Well, it should be Shogaku Shunryu, Hakuyu Taizan, and Jikai Daimin. And I just have forgotten to make that change in our liturgy. And he was ordained by Maizumi Roshi in 1979 and completed formal koan study under Maizumi Roshi. In 1984, Gemio-san continued his training with someone who is dear to us all, Joko Beck, in San Diego. And he received Dharma transmission and authorization to teach from Joko in 1992. And he is also the author of a book that has to do with the precepts called Ordinary Life, Wondrous Life, which you can get from by logging on to Prairie Zen Center's website. Mm-hmm. And so without further ado, I present to you Gemio-san.
Thank you. The first case in the Denkoroku introduction, Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha, seeing the morning star, gained enlightenment and said, I and all beings of the great earth have in the same moment attained the way. The poem for this. One branch from the old plum tree extends splendidly forth. Thorns become attached to it in time. I thought I would talk about this case, since we're approaching Buddha's Enlightenment Day, Bodhi Day, which in our tradition, we celebrate December 8th, and whatever day around that works in your schedule. And also, since I understand that some of you have studied this with your teacher, Zuiko, so you are already familiar with this. But we can never become too familiar with this. So So I will speak a little bit about this, and maybe afterwards we could speak together about it. Shakyamuni Buddha, seeing the morning star, attained enlightenment and said, I and all beings of the great earth. Some translations, probably more literally correct, say, I and all sentient beings of the great earth. So, sentient beings, it's a very tricky word for us, because we have all sorts of ideas of what sentient is and isn't. And in a way, if we get stuck in those ideas, then in a sense we miss this whole case. We miss Buddha's enlightenment. It's just recently I saw an article about someone who is a scientist who's working on a program in Dharamsala teaching Tibetan nuns and monks science. It's the program is actually teaching them basic science and math. And this is initiated by the Dalai Lama. He wanted the monks and nuns to appreciate science. So this is a program that's in conjunction with Emory University. I'm not going to talk much about that, the program, but there's one interesting experiment that the person writing this article who was teaching them talked about. He had the monks and nuns get cotton swabs and get some bacteria, either from their ears or other parts of their body, and put them on, grow the bacteria on, some of you know about the science, they use agar dishes and so on and so forth. They first grew the bacteria and then did experiments with the bacteria using microscopes and projected microscopes so that they actually could see it in the classroom, how the bacteria was reacting to various things, responding to various things. Because the question that he posed at the beginning for these experiments was, for each of the students, is, are bacteria sentient beings or not? So the article talks about what they did, but at the end of the class, he records, he said that half of the students decided bacteria were sentient beings, and half decided they weren't sentient beings. These are Tibetan monks and nuns who are somewhat, have been practicing for a while. So now this, in a way, throws up a lot of ideas that how do we deal with bacteria if there are or aren't sentient beings? What's sentient beings? That's why, in a way, I like to say I and all beings of the great earth. And we don't get so trapped in that. And in a way, it forces us to expand beings. What is this all beings of the great earth? Are the walls, the shelves, the floor, are those beings? I'm sure some of you are familiar with koans where Buddha mind is the tiles, the rocks. The voice of the Buddha is the stream. I and all beings of the great earth in the same moment attain the way. What are we talking about? What is this I and all beings? What about different states of mind, states of body, all sorts of conditions that we seem to enter and leave? Are those included in this same moment attained way? in a way, this isn't so simple, because when we don't see this I and all beings together attaining the way, then we don't see the way. Then we don't see what Buddha's awakening is, what our awakening is. See? When we take refuge in Buddha, we're taking refuge in Buddha's awakening. What is this, taking refuge in this awakening? See, that's something we have to really see for ourselves. Despite the fact that I and all beings, which includes every one of us, have in the same moment attained the way. So, what does Keizan Zenji say about this? He says, Keizan, I shouldn't assume anything. Keizan Zenji, who's the author of the Denko Roku, was the fourth ancestor in Japan in the Soto school. Ehe Dogen, Kon Eju, Tetsu Gikai, Keizan Joken. So, Keizan is who we're talking about. This Denko Roku, transmission of light, or the book of the transmission of light. You can translate the Ko a little differently if you want. I think you call it transmission of brightness. Did I hear something?
Ko, light.
Yeah.
Transmission of light.
Yeah. Well, transmission of light. And the text starts with Shakyamuni Buddha and goes one ancestor after another in the Zen lineage up to Kōen Edzo. So it has Ehe Dōgen and Kōen Edzo, and then it stops at that point. And in each of the personages, there's the case, like this one, and then there's a verse that Keizan appended to it, and the verses actually are linked. If you look at the text, you see, even though there's a verse for each case, the verse for the first case, in a sense, is linked to the second case, is linked to the third case, and you could see similar themes develop. And then he's wrote an extended commentary on the case. Some of it has to do with history, or let me say, it's not accurate history, but the history that was known and mythologized to a certain extent at that point, because scholars now will say all sorts of things about how the history is. But anyway, the history of the person, in other words, something about who they were, how they began practicing, and then talking about their actual practice in terms of the case, the transmission. And the case has to do with the teacher and the disciple, the person receiving the transmission. Of course, in the first case, it's Shakyamuni Buddha. So it's Shakyamuni Buddha seeing the morning star. So Keizan says, this so-called I is not Shakyamuni Buddha. Even Shakyamuni Buddha is born of this I. Certainly you, I, all beings are born of this I. See? The whole earth and all beings come forth from this I. So, if we say that, what is this? What is this that from the beginning we are? If we say this unborn Buddha mind, if I use that kind of word. See? And this, in a way, is not so simple for us, because we tend to think that our practice is our own practice, and whatever we get is something that we ourselves get. and something Buddha got back there, and yet here I and all beings together have attained the way. I and all beings in the same moment, not now and then, in the same moment. This is the text. What are they talking about? How is that even possible? I mean, Buddha's, let's say, 2400, 2500, 2300 years ago, doesn't make a difference the exact accurate date. What does it mean? I and all beings. See? What is this? Keizan wants to help us a little with this, so he says a little more. When a great net is hauled up from the sea, all the openings in the net are hauled up with it. Likewise, when Gautama attains the way, beings of the earth also attain the way. Not only beings of the earth, but Buddhas, enlightened ones of past, present, and future. What does that mean? How do we practice and live in a world where we are the attained way? But not just we ourselves separate somewhere inside here, but we with all beings that we encounter. This is what he's talking about. We with all conditions of body, mind that appear, arise as our life. It's not my words. It's Buddha's words. It's Keizan Zenji's words. That's what he's talking about. See? What is this intimacy of I and all beings? What is seeing the morning star? What is that? What is Buddha doing? Seeing the morning star. How is that attaining the way? Or gaining enlightenment, whichever word you want to use. How is that the attained way? See, what is that that we think that is? Is it something out there? He saw something there and that sparked something inside here? Inside him? And then he had some special state of mind occur and then he became whatever you want to think? How is it possible to say, I in all beings? Or another way we say it is, all beings are the wisdom and the perfection of the Buddha. What does that mean? Because that's another aspect of this, if I say it this way. Those quotes actually are probably from the Avatamsaka Sutra. Avatamsaka Sutra, it's also known as the Yen Sutra. Some of you might be familiar with it. It's a text particularly popular in China and in obviously also in Japan and elsewhere. So that's where these quotes are from. See? And these questions that I ask, these tendencies to misunderstand, aren't just something that we hear in America. Keizan addresses them specifically. He says, don't hold a false notion of Gautama becoming Shakyamuni and realizing enlightenment. Wow. In a way, that's the opposite of what we've always been told. He says, don't hold a false notion of Gautama becoming Shakyamuni and realizing enlightenment. Or, if I say it another way, Shakyamuni has no thought of attaining the way. What is this attaining the way? Or whatever word we want to use, the way, enlightenment, or any kind of word. Now, this is the first case of this whole book of transmission of light. So he's setting forth the basis of what everything that's going to come afterwards. This is setting the base out of which everything else is more elaboration, if I say it in such a way. So if we misunderstand it, if we approach it with a sense of getting something that I'm going to get, that I'm lacking, that I need, then already we're in trouble. At least as far as what Kazen Zenji is saying. At least as far as what Shakyamuni is saying. And yet we have that tendency. We believe we're lacking something and we're going to get something, and what we're going to get is going to fix the problems, and the problems are going to go away, and the problems are not part of this attained way. Just like we have ideas that some people who haven't yet come in here and sat with us, they aren't included yet. Only those in here maybe are. So that must be what Shakyamuni, I and all sentient beings who are in the Zen Center or who are practicing. Well, no, we aren't quite that crude, but we do exclude all sorts of people and all sorts of beings from this attained way. Maybe the cats in this house are included, but I'm not sure about the wild cats out in the street. And all sorts of exclusions, all sorts of beings that we exclude, and all sorts of conditions that we exclude. See, states of mind. See, what is it to be intimate as a state of mind, as a state of condition, as a state of body? Healthy, not so healthy. How do we see that as this attained way, this net? When one piece is pulled up, the rest is pulled up, as Kazen Zenji says it. What is this solitary body revealed in the myriad forms? If we use that kind of word. What is this? I mean, myriad forms. In this morning service, it talked about myriad forms. Myriad forms of emptiness, if I use that kind of word. What is that? What is the myriad forms that we encounter from morning to night? See, so how do we practice, live, manifest a universe of I and all beings having being the attained way? What are we taking refuge in when we take refuge in Buddha's attainment? See, this morning you took refuge. What is it you're taking refuge in? So, in a way, this case is an encouragement. It's an encouragement for all of us to see what we are doing when we practice. To remind us, despite the fact that we might hold ideas otherwise, to remind us who and what we are. Because if we don't see who and what we are, then our approach to practice becomes a continuation of, if I call it, dualistic way of living life. And to conceptualize, you could say that's just the opposite of what this first case is about. And yet it's the tendency that seems so natural to us. It seems so natural, and yet when we go on with it, we see that the consequences of that aren't what we want. The consequences are suffering. The consequences are stress. The consequences are greed and anger and all sorts of other manifestations and variations of that. So the reason to bring this up is not that you need to get some new ideas, not that you need to agree with me or disagree with me. That's fine. All with Keizan Zenji, all with Shakyamuni Buddha. If you disagree, wonderful. Then that's exactly why we have to do the experiment with our practice. See? And then see for ourselves what's included and what's not included as our life. What are we able to be intimate as and what are we not? That's our opportunity of zazen and of practice. Because in that effort, in that discovery, in that chewing up of it, we can begin to clarify our life. We can begin to clarify this treasure of Buddha's awakening that, at least they say, is our awakening. I and all beings together in the same moment. And somehow you're included in that. Even if you think your neighbor or someone else in the family might not be included because of A, B, C, D, or the person who you have difficulty with at work, or, and you fill in, or, and they say, all beings of the great earth. So not just people here in Iowa, or people here in the Midwest, or people here in North America, or people, and you go on. In fact, not just people. All beings. So we don't have to decide for the monks in Dharamsala whether bacteria are or aren't sentient beings. But we certainly encounter lots of beings, conditions, circumstances in our daily life. How do we be the intimacy of this encounter of the attained way? Okay. Now, when I talk, there's no point in me telling you something that's in a book or that's mine. The only point of us speaking together is to clarify practice. So what I will do now is stop and we'll open it up to questions, comments, and anything and everything is fair play to bring up, although I might not answer. But you're free to bring up and I'll do my best. Also, please be comfortable. I know this might go on longer than you're comfortable sitting upright. So be comfortable and bring up what you wish.
All right. So what if you see a sentient being, like a spider, and you're thinking, we're just going to let this spider be, and someone else might come along and stomp on the spider. Uh-huh. So how can you let that person be maybe where they are and without judgment, but yet there's a dead spider?
And let's go back even further. First, there's use the word without judgment. What do you do when judgments arise? What do you do when judgment arise for the spider? Ah, that spider's a black widow. What am I going to do about that? See, if you have an idea, let it be, means, oh yeah, spider's there, I'm here, I can't do anything, that becomes a very rigid, stiff way of functioning. That's not real life. Okay? What do you do with a spider?
Take it outside.
Ooh, that's one way to do it.
What if it's really cold? Die.
So what do you do about cold weather? That's right, good. What do you do about cold weather? Will the spider die or live out there? I don't know. What are you going to do about it? Good question. Okay. Well,
at least it's not in my bedroom.
But then it'll crawl up from the basement into your house. Or what's going to happen when you walk down in the basement and put your hand on the wall and there's a spider? It's a poisonous spider. See, practice isn't about being rigid or stupid in a sense of doing something because it sounds good here, but it doesn't work in this moment of reality. Mm-hmm. Now, if you put your hand down and didn't see the spider and the spider bit you, then you get to deal with being poisoned. And that's... But our functioning is about responding to the present moment. But it's responding to the present moment as our life. See, what is our life? Our life is this attained way. But it doesn't mean we just sit rigid all the time, even in a day of practice, even in a session. You go out and you do work. And session begins and ends, and it doesn't end except that it stops, and then you go back to the rest of your life, and you started with the rest of your life. Your practice isn't just, you know, some narrow space, but it's all sorts of functioning. And your functioning could be as a person who deals with spiders. What do you do with spiders? So, in a way, what it calls for is being present with the spider, being able to see the spider for what he, she is, and then doing what's called for out of being where you are. And who else is in the house? If you have children, are you going to say, oh, we'll put it down in the basement? And the children go down to the basement? And what if you happen to have a pet iguana? And the pet iguanas eat spiders, among other insects. What are you going to do? Or a pet cat.
There you go.
But there are other kinds of spiders. The spider outside is easier. It's the spiders that arise in our mind, of all sorts of spiders. What do we do when we notice that those have arisen? See, that's really where our practice is. And we could talk about them in generalities. You know, we could say greed and anger are spiders that appear. Even sitting silently zazen, and all of a sudden greed or anger can appear. What do we do with that? How do we practice skillfully with it? Do we try to stomp it? And that's not such good practice. Do we put it in the basement? That's not such good practice either. So what do we do skillfully with all sorts of conditions? Fear. What do we do with the spider of fear appears in our life? How do we practice skillfully body-mind fear? Fear isn't just mental. It's this whole body-mind functioning, this whole body-mind world functioning. Fear is inside and outside if you're in a group of people. How do we function and practice with that and respond to that? What sort of ideas do you hold about this Buddha seeing the morning star attained enlightenment? I'm sure you've all heard that story times and again. Even, I mean, some of you have studied this, so you're already experts with when you had the class on this matter. But most of us have heard about Buddha's enlightenment. And there's all sorts of stories that are built up on it. But what do we imagine that is? What is
it? Isn't this exactly what he said? I mean, he really saw. He saw the morning star. He was very present to it. It doesn't mean any more than that. That's my thought. It's just a moment where he and we can be very conscious in the present of only that.
And when he saw the morning star, was he and the morning star the same or different?
I mean, moments of enlightenment, I think of is when we realize that it's all the same thing. Our face is that star. Star is our face.
And what does that mean? If you say it's the same, then what is that? I mean, are you and the spider the same? Do we live that way?
Yes.
So what does it mean, the same? I mean, we said this morning in the service there was identity. I don't know, identity of relative and absolute. I don't remember. You used a slightly different translation for the Sambhakai title. But in any case...
These translations, I mean...
Yeah, but,
whatever.
But... how do we hold both the sameness and the sameness and the difference? And the sameness and the difference are, if I say it in this way, two sides of it. So there's always difference when there's sameness. There's always sameness when there's difference. See, so in a way saying, well, Buddha and the morning star are one. But then I'd be afraid to be near Buddha because he's, you know, transmitting this tremendous burning energy of a star. I mean, so that's not, it's not quite that, and yet it's not quite not that. So what is it? Buddha seeing the morning star. What is this I and all beings together attaining the way? So that's in a way what we have to make alive for ourselves. How do we, or the other way is, how don't we live that in our daily functioning? And there's lots of ways we can see where we don't live. I and all beings. I and the spider. I and you fill in. I don't have to give you specifics in our own life that aren't included in our attained way when they show up. Whether it's the achy knees or whether it's the person who's always nasty when I run into them at the family gatherings, or how do we see them? They're the same morning star, or are they? It's easy to talk about Buddha and morning stars. It's much more difficult to talk about the family gathering with Aunt so-and-so who always is bugging me about, and you fill in what she bugs you about. And yet, are those the same or different? Is Aunt Mary the same as me? Is she different? And how do I be with her being same, different? Being identity of relative and absolute. See, that's why our practice is always about where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. And what we're doing here in the Zendo is easy. Even though, my knees ache, and it doesn't seem easy at all when that's happening. And yet it is easy. It's easy. It's good for us to see what beings we're not sure of are part of our life, that we're not sure we want to be intimate with. And I don't mean sure up here, because in it's not what we think out, but what we sense in our own reactions to circumstances, or to conditions, or to people, or to events. Because that's where we see where it's not I and all this being, or I and this circumstance together. This one is, you know, one of the excluded ones. Maybe 99% are included, but there's 1% that's excluded. Even that 1% is connected with all the 99, which in a sense excludes the 99 as well, whether we agree with that or not. Doesn't say I and all sentient beings except for the 1% have attained the way. Buddha doesn't say it that way. I mean, at least the sutra doesn't say it that way. It doesn't say all beings except the 1%, except the 2%, except Aunt Mary are the wisdom and perfection of Buddha. Doesn't say that. And you could fill in. I mean, I shouldn't be picking on Aunt Mary, since some of you might have Aunt Marys, so please excuse me. I pick a name, but I don't mean. See, this is a very good time, because some people are going to go see family or go to family situations. And I've heard that is sometimes a difficult situation. Sometimes. So that's great practice. You should consider it like you're getting a sesshin with all sorts of trimmings thrown in. Fancy food and, you know. And no one else has to know that except you. See, Aunt Mary doesn't have to change. Aunt Mary doesn't have to be any different. See, how do we appreciate... Well, change it. How do we appreciate Uncle Joe, even though he's had a few too many drinks and he's being obnoxious about that thing that he keeps on telling me since I've been a little kid? He always brings up that stuff every year. He never changes, even though... See, how do we appreciate him at that moment as the wisdom and the perfection of the Buddha? And there is no formula. How do I see Uncle Joe Morning Star? Uncle Joe Morning Star. And it's up to us to be intimate as Uncle Joe Morning Star. Or, rather than saying, oh, I've got to try to make him, noticing how we don't want to make him, noticing what we believe about Uncle Joe and how he should be different. And if he only saw it my way, he finally... See, then that's the place, because that's right there we could see when those thoughts and feelings arise. And if we see them bodily and can practice in them, then we could take care of what we need to at this moment. Because it's up to us at this moment to make Uncle Joe the attained way. Uncle Joe attaining the way. It's not up to Uncle Joe to make the attained way. It's up to us. That's our practice. We have to manifest that.
There's a point in all of this where I want to put a name to it.
Yes.
And there's also a large part of me that doesn't want to put a name to it, realizing that if I put a name to it, I somehow limit it.
What do you mean by put a name to it?
To understand it cognitively. Mm-hmm.
But be more specific. What do you give me an example of what you mean by put a name to it?
There's something when I read that story, the Buddha, there's something profoundly ineffable about it. Something beyond my ability to name, to describe logically, sequentially, rationally, and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And a part of me likes that, to kind of keep it in that ineffable realm.
Uh-huh.
But I've been realizing recently that there's also a part of me that likes to hide behind that concept of ineffability. And there's something else going on there that I'm not allowing myself just to see, realize, feel, except I...
Okay. Let's turn it a little differently. You are ineffable. There are, if I say it this way, aspects of who you are that are ineffable to you.
Yeah.
And really what it's about is being willing to be the ineffable and function out of the ineffable aspects of yourself. So it's not that this story about the Buddha is ineffable. It's that we aren't limited to the, what should I say? I'll use the word effable. I don't want to say but the conscious stories that we call the effable ones, the ones that I could easily articulate and list out and of who we are. I am someone who likes to do this, who thinks like this, who believes this, who feels this. Those are the effable ones. Mm-hmm. But if we limit ourselves to those, then we limit our life to those. Never, even though that isn't our life, because our life is, as you use the word, the ineffable aspects as well. And that's accessible to us. We're able to function out of that if we let go holding on to the effable, the thoughts, feelings, attachments, to use generalities, but the specific ones, when they come up, where they blind and hinder us. So then, it's not about the story, but that if anything, the story is a pointer back to our own life practice, to our own functioning as the perfection and wisdom of Buddha, not in some nicey-nice way, but as the reality of how we are. Our functioning as I and all beings of the attained way. I and the whole earth. How do I function as that? Or at least how do I not hold on to the effable that contradicts that? That wants me to say, oh, I'm not that far. Maybe there's some fancy ineffable aspect in that story, but that's not here, this one. It's just the opposite. That's the point of cases like this, or I can call this a koan like this. So, ineffable is a fancy word, but they're simpler words. Fancy words are useful for those of us who like to, conceptualize and think about things, but sometimes they become ways that we hide from ourself and from our life in the words. So it's always better to try to simplify it.
Yeah.
if we can simplify it and make it ordinary, then we could see more clearly what we are or aren't saying or are not doing or what is skillful and appropriate. It's always in the specifics about Uncle Joe, Cousin Bob, or, and I just pick those because of the season. And, does that make sense? You can.
Something that, or some, many of the things you've said this morning make me think about, okay, in my background, we tell people don't internalize things that are painful, things that annoy you, things that hurt, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You can see those things for what they are, but don't let them get inside you. But it seems to me that that's not the way, because to see Uncle Joe as the morning star, you have to be able to internalize him. You have to be able to see him as part of the whole humanity that you're part of. You can't see Uncle Joe's humanity if you hold him, if you don't internalize him.
Yeah, if you hold on to internal and not internal, or mine and not mine, it's fine to use as a word. You know, this stick is in my hand, it's not in your hand. But if you hold on to that as a rigid concept and you try to live out of that, then it becomes a hindrance rather than just a phrase and an approach that you could use, pick up when you want to and put it down when the meal's over. Otherwise, you're just carrying around a spoon all day or a hammer all day and potentially hammering on glass when, you know, you only needed it for the nail in the morning. So if, let's say, one has a tendency to use the word you use, internalize all sorts of things, then maybe it's skillful to say it's important to notice not to internalize what's not yours, because you just create more suffering and difficulties if you do that. But if to see that that's just something that you do when that tendency arises or when that situation arises, and that doing that is not skillful in that situation, but it might be skillful at other times, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So it might be skillful to say, when you run into Uncle Joe at the family gathering and he's going on about whatever he goes on about, not to take it, quote, personally, and yet to take it personally. So it depends. So sometimes it's very important for people who take personally all sorts of things for them to learn not to, and vice versa. See, part of practice is learning to practice intelligently, mm-hmm. which means that being present so that we can be in this moment, situation, circumstances, or if I use fancy words, this moment arising, passing of the, you know, conditions, if we could say this karmic moment, if I use that word, or this dharmic moment, then we could see what to do. If we're not here, or if we're caught up in our beliefs, then we can't see what to do, because we only see through what we're caught up in. And then sometimes what we do is skillful, and sometimes what we do is creates more trouble, more entanglements. Now it's fine, we are all entangled, and yet how do we live freely in midst of the entanglements that we are? See, that's why it's always, practice is always in the specifics, not in the generalities. It's always in how do I what to do right now, what to do right now, what to, and it doesn't come out of figuring it all out, but out of being present. Out of being present, the bell rings. Get up. Don't have to figure it all out. In a sense, a lot of what we do in the Zendo is we start responding without thinking from a deeper place, viscerally, if I say it in such a way, to clappers and bells and whatever else. And that we begin to see that it's possible for us to respond in life in that way. I'll say from ineffable as opposed to just the effable. Doesn't exclude the effable. It's just that sometimes that's not so useful. Actually, I don't know what the word effable literally means. I think one of the best dharmic instruments is a dictionary, because if you look in it, you start seeing some of the things that you mean when you, or that you assume when you use certain words, especially if it's about your life or other people or circumstances. You use words and then sometimes say, oh, I didn't realize that that's always what I, and we often do mean that. We assume that and we hold on to that and we get trapped by that. So, when I will look up what effable means and see more.
I will too, but I have no idea exactly what it might say in the dictionary, but I was thinking effable, ineffable is showing the distinction, that difference thing. Like, and I'm reading this book on the Heart Sutra, it's like, shunyata, emptiness and form, mm-hmm. and they're really the same, and yet not. And like what you said about mm-hmm. the harmony or the identity of sameness and difference is just so. All these things about me that I've labeled and classified and stuff, they are the ineffable.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it. I don't know how you say. I mean, they use. Light has been used by every religion as mm-hmm. the ineffable coming being in us, and
yet it's the ineffable is the effable, as you're saying yes. in the Heart Sutra. Mm-hmm. Ku is shiki sokoze ku, ku sokoze shiki. That's just the, in other words, because I'm going to get to that. That means form is. Emptiness, to use a word. Now, emptiness is a problematic word in English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like sometimes also use the word boundlessness.
Yeah, that's
which is another word. Again, it's the word is ku means shunyata. It's the Japanese, Sino-Japanese way of pronouncing the character, which means shunyata. So, in a sense, it's that form and emptiness, or form and boundlessness, are right here. They're not two different things. And yet, it's so natural for us to see form as form, mm-hmm. and not to see the other side of it, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. I say other side. And then sometimes we actually have to do the reverse. Sometimes we get, we see the other side, we see, if I use the word dharmakaya or the emptiness, but then we have to also see the form side and have to be able to function back and forth, because it's both at the same time. It's the identity, not anything but the identity or the sameness of relative and absolute, if we use those terms. Again, when we translate into English, it's great, it's important for us, since but at the same time, we often bring along connotations and denotations of the English of our own that we're not aware of. And seeing that sometimes helps us become clearer on what our assumptions have been or are about functions in our life, about aspects of our life.
Uncle Joe.
Okay. Or Aunt Mary, or and you fill in. There's no one here named Joe. Yes. This is your chance. Anything you want. It doesn't have to be something that I've said here. It could be about something else.
I have to leave to work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the disruption.
We should probably finish up if no one has a question. If someone has a question, this is your last 10 seconds. And then we can finish up in time to have a little bit of tea and zazen at, I think, probably 11:25 or 11:30. What time is it at the moment?
It is 11:01.
Yeah, 11:30 maybe, given about 30 minutes.
No, this says it's 10:48.
Oh, I was going, yeah, it's 10. Yeah, I went backwards. My clock is 6 minutes faster. That one's so I was ineffable.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, 11.
It's
11:20 this clock. We have stopped there. Yeah.
May this merit extend universally to all, so that we, together with all beings, realize